So without any more ado, I'm going to ask Doug to come and speak. This is the man that has led this men's ministry and made it what it is. So let's give him a real round of a good round of applause.
Well, thanks indeed, Bill, for that. That's just marvellous. And I want to say to you men, thank you so much for your enormous generosity, just beyond my understanding. This marvellous set of golf clubs here, and so I appreciate that. I've brought them just in case you didn't see. You might have contributed and haven't yet seen them. Don't mess with them. They're still being run in, I tell you. Somebody said, will I give a demonstration this morning? And the answer is no. Okay. Bill said that I should go along to the golf shop where he bought the clubs, and you can have them tested, and will they fit me and all of that sort of thing. So I went into the golf club, or the golf shop rather, in Kew, and the guy said, "Come over here," and I stood up against the wall. And he announced with great confidence, he says, "You're very ordinary." Well, I always knew as a kid that I thought I was really ordinary, and so it was no surprise to hear somebody really say that, but nobody said that to me in recent times, and it did take me back a bit.
You were average.
No, he said I was very ordinary. Now, when I was growing up as a kid, in country towns around Victoria, I'd always thought that I was pretty ordinary. And in fact, as life went on, I came to realise that because I had a mum and dad who really cared for one another, and they really cared for me, and I had a much older brother, 13 years older than I was, who we never lived at home together that I can recall, that in fact, I was really very, very fortunate. At my brother's funeral in 1998, I said something like this. When you're about 5 or 6 years of age and your brother who doesn't live with you comes home and spends some time with you and teaches you to play games or musical instruments and things like that, that's about as close to heaven as a small boy gets. So I was very, very fortunate as we grew up in country towns around Victoria. My dad was a manager of some of you will recall, just put your hand up if you recall the State Savings Bank of Victoria. It's a bit of a defining moment in Victorian history. So I lived in country towns like Bright and Yumurka and Portland, and came to the city and went to Northcote High School for a while in the early 50s, mid-50s, and then went to Benalla. And there I was enjoying a lot of sport and finished schooling there, and I came to understand that if you wanted to be good at sport, you needed to be in the bank, because most of the guys who were in the bank then finished at about 3:30 in the afternoon and spent the rest of the afternoon on the tennis court or the golf course, and they were the club champions all around the town. So that was really interesting. So I finished schooling and thought, coming from a banking family, my brother was a banker as well, I'll join the Commonwealth Bank, which I did in 1959. And then I had some success during that time in tennis and in golf. Some of that's much decline. But as I enjoyed that and the accolades that went with it, I had this sneaking suspicion that being at the top of the sporting tree, although it's vitally important in Australia, there's more to life than this. So in 1961, I came to the city. I met my wife, Elizabeth. Many of you know Elizabeth. We met on a blind date at what was then the Clayton Drive-In through some friends of ours. And we corresponded. I came back to the city. We lived in... We married and came to this church. Some people knocked on the door in 1964 and said, "I'm from St. Alfred's Church. We're down the road. would you like to come and join us? Now, we were both Anglicans, and so I came. In about 1965, my career in the bank started to take off. Now, this happens to a lot of young blokes, about in their mid-20s, about 30, and my career was elevated to a sort of an elite team of people who were called cadets in those times. I was doing some part-time study. We had a child in 1966, and I was at full stretch. Life was pretty complex, it seemed. I attended a course at the instigation of my employer, the Commonwealth Bank. They sent me to a course in the Dandenongs. This was a three-day course. People from all sorts of walks of life, like the BHPs of the time and organisations to do with local and state government were there. It was a time where we were being challenged to think about the world in which we live. It was about social responsibility. And I laughed to myself, my organisation thinks I'm a social irresponsible. But after 3 days, I was a bit of a psychological wreck. They'd asked me lots of questions. We'd had lots of discussions. There were no answers, it seemed, to the questions, and every question that they asked raised in my mind about another half a dozen questions that I still didn't have answers for. I needed to find some answers pretty quick. I was all at sea. My doctor described it as a bit of a brainwash. Things like suicide came to mind, but I didn't contemplate that too seriously. But I could understand how people could be in a state of depression and didn't know where to go. I needed some direction in life, and pretty quick. I spoke to our clergy who was there, a guy by the name of Reverend Kevin Curnow. Some of you may remember him. And he put in my hand a little book called Man Alive. And Man Alive is a little about 90 pages, and it talks about the historical evidence for the resurrection. Now, I'd been a churchgoer for about all of my life, and I'd want to say that the church life that I was engaged in and the rest of life were on two parallel tracks, a bit like the train tracks, and they were never going to meet. But this little book pointed out that the resurrection of Jesus is the most significant and best attested to fact of history in the last 2,000 years. So I read that and I began to find some purpose and direction in life. That was absolutely vital for me. Intellectually, my world had been turned upside down. The course that I'd gone to in the Dandenong Ranges for 3 days, I was ill-prepared for that. There were so many issues in life that I hadn't even touched on. I was a young bloke who was keen on sport, done some accounting and law studies, a bit to do with banking, and as I travelled around in life, I hadn't thought about any of the, perhaps questions that these guys had been raising. Admittedly, they were university academics and they were sort of pressing a few buttons, I suspect. But I didn't have any response, really, to any of these serious questions. So this helped me to find a worldview. Now, men, I believe, here today, some of you have worked out a worldview. Some of you have taken all of life to work out this worldview, and it's something that men cling to tenaciously, even in the face of substantial evidence to the contrary. And so it's important to be able to explore beyond your worldview, particularly for some of you young guys here. You've learned a lot about life. But I want to tell you an important principle, and that is that what you don't know can really hurt you. particularly when you get to things like marriage and being a parent. There's a whole bucket of things there that you think, wow, this ought to be pretty straightforward. You know, generations have done this before me, but it ain't necessarily so. One of the things that began to happen in my life in the late 60s was that the Bible became immediately sort of relevant. All of a sudden, I'm starting to find, wow, this Bible's talking about things that I need to know. I'm finding real answers here. This is sensational. And so we continued to grow in the Christian sense, and I began to explore how to bring that into the workplace where I was working. There were men that I worked with who were really good role models in my organisation, and some of them were Christian, and I'm glad I was able to lean on them. Around about, let's just move on a little bit, around about 1980, we had a clergyman here whose name was Graham Sells. Just indicate if you remember Graham Sells. I know who we're talking about. Okay. Graham Sells, as you might know, was the first vicar of St Alfred's here in a time when we only had the old hall out here, and we were a much smaller church than we are today. But he laid a lot of foundations because he was a very creative sort of a guy, and he'd go away on holidays to the US and to other places, and he'd come home and he'd say, I've seen this, some of these really ideas from America are really fantastic. You know, they've got breakfast going for blokes over in the United States, and they seem to be pretty good. I wonder if we could do that. And I thought about it for a while. I thought, oh, yeah, we could do that. We might get a dozen blokes for a breakfast, and that'd be okay. Well, we never had less than 23, and I suppose we've got 60 or so plus here this morning, and we've had as many as about 130. So that's just something that happened. But over time, as I potted around in this area of men's ministry, I discovered some things. Now, I'm going to talk about a few things here shortly, and some of them will be statistical, and I know at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning, blokes are not geared for statistics. I've done enough of this. So I've got a handout for you. It's on the chair. It was on the chair over here that Arkin's got now. He'll make sure you get one. So you can take it away and ponder some of the things I'm about to talk about. 36% of church attendances across Australia are male. Now, that's nearly it's a bit over one third. So the corollary of that is that in most churches around Australia, on average, there are two women for one bloke. Now, that's not a very encouraging thing for men in the church, I might say. At this church, I just want to say that the numbers have been over the last three National Church Life Surveys, a period of 8 years. In 2001, we had 48%. In 2006, we had 41%. And just recently, we did one in November, the last one in 2011, the number was 45%. So you blokes in this community here need to recognise that you are doing something which is quite unusual in the church community. When men attend church, 90% of the time, their families come with them. Whereas if it's only, say, mum who's coming, then the reality is that number falls to about 25 to 30%. So men and dads set the tone for the spiritual life of their families. Now, some of you guys suspect that here who are dads and granddads. Some of you guys who are not yet married and are thinking about all of this stuff in the future, this is never going to happen to me, just salt away that this is vital, okay, for your family's well-being and for you in the future as a dad. It goes without saying that men and women respond differently. And there's a book which I brought this morning, if you want to just show you. Why Men Hate Going to Church. Now, this is put together by a bloke who's in the United States, and it's not quite parallel because the United States and so on have got some different cultural issues. But most of the stuff that's in here is applicable in one way or another to Australia. So if any of you are serious about thinking about what it is, the way in which men and women respond differently in the church culture, that's not a bad starting point. In our culture, the proportion of males in our jails are round about 90%. 90%. It says something about men and the way in which they move in social issues. There's roomfuls of books written about this sort of stuff. Let me give you a little story. In the United States, the same sort of thing would happen here in Australia, but in the United States, there was a card publishing thing, greeting card house, and they thought, Mother's Day's coming up, we'll better go off to the prison, we'll take some cards, maybe we'll sell some cards because Mother's Day's coming up. Well, they took them along and they put the cards out. It was, publicised, and things went well. They sold lots of cards. Inmates came and bought cards and sent them off to their mums, and that was terrific. They thought, wow, what a success story. You can just see the marketing manager and sales manager smiling, and it was terrific. They thought, Dad's Day's coming up shortly. Let's do the same thing. Off they go to the jail. They sell, put the cards out. How many cards do you think they sold? Zero. The underlying problem for most people who are in socially dysfunctional parts of their life is, for blokes, is that they've really got a poor relationship with their dad. Either no relationship at all or a very poor relationship. Let me just give you a stat here for a moment. Steve Bidolf. Who's heard of Steve Bidolf? Okay, that's good. He's written quite a number of important books. He's not a Christian writer, but he writes a book called Manhood and Raising Boys. I believe he's got some quite insightful things to say about men in Australian culture. Steve Bidolf says a number of things. 30% of men in Australia have no relationship with their father whatsoever. 30% of men in Australia have a sort of an abrasive and very testy relationship with Dad. They see Dad, but he's a stupid old bastard, and he's just, he's off the planet. But we're in touch with Dad. 30% have a relationship with their dad, which is a sort of a come and go, a fairly superficial relationship. We might have a few beers together. We might go to the footy together. We might do some stuff at Christmas and birthday times and that sort of thing. So there are three groups there. Only 10% of men in Australia have a relationship with their dad where the son can say, my dad is an emotional ally in my life. My dad is an emotional ally in my life. Now, just let me ask just a bit of a straw poll here. I'm going to ask you to have a few little conversations in a moment. Who here this morning has got a dad who they can say is, I've got an emotional ally or has been an emotional ally in my life? Put your hand up if you... Okay. That's probably a bit better than 10%, but it's probably one of the reasons why you're part of a church community. Okay? Now, I need to issue a disclaimer here, because I've sort of couched the talk this morning in the importance of men. And that is to say that this has got nothing to do with the role of women in the church or anything to do with the female sex at all. It's just that, generally speaking, blokes find the whole issue of taking on an identity as a strong, emotionally strong man morally strong men is a really tough thing for blokes in Australia. And so there's been, in the last couple of decades, quite a strong resurgence of women in the church taking on leadership roles and other things. That's not what I'm touching on today, nor do I want to denigrate that in any way. It's just all about, how can we lift blokes up? Have a think just for a moment. The number of issues that you see happening in your community or in your life experience where men are being lifted up, okay, to be, you know, strong and taking principled stands. Where is that happening? Outside, perhaps, of those who are involved in this community. I suspect not many. On the other hand, pornography, to some extent, for some men, prostitution, gambling, and all of it is really at the forefront of life. And I want to tell you that in my experience, life is much beyond all of that. Now, I'd just like to do a little bit of a straw poll here today, and I'd like in a moment for you to just talk to the person who's next to you, perhaps either side, and this is a life experience issue for you in terms of, this is just out of your own personal experience, and you can either say yes or one or two. Men come to faith generally around the church. So I want you to think, is your faith something which you've acquired at the church or connected with people at the church? That's option one. Option two is that maybe you picked up, the Bible or a Christian book at some stage or other, and of your own volition, you came to faith. You read this, you absorbed it, you might have seen a DVD, but you weren't connected with the church or people in the church, okay? Two options. In one, the church and its community is central. The other one is not... not central at all. It didn't figure. Maybe God, as I read from time to time, God speaks into people, gives them visions, dreams, and they become convicted and become believers in Christ as a result of that. Can I just ask you to talk to the people near you, next to you, and say, which one is it for you? Which one for you? You've got 2 minutes to do that. Okay, hope you've got to the bottom of that. Can I just ask then, as a bit of a straw poll, who's come to faith here? Just indicate, not going to embarrass you anyway, but just indicate, did you come to faith through your connection with the church? Just indicate. Okay, for those who didn't come to faith through the church but through some other way. Okay. Thanks for doing that. The numbers are probably in the order of, just my guess, 5 to 10%. Now, that confirms what I've come to believe firmly, and that is that 85 to 90% of men come to faith when they're connected to the church. So part of the basis that I've been working on in recent years in terms of men's ministry, and I know men are keen about this, is that we need to have as many open doors into the church as possible. Hence, we've got things like motorcycle groups. Some blokes love to get out and, blow the cobwebs away. Some blokes like to go on four-wheel drives. Some blokes like to dirty their hands and go and dig up the widow's back garden to give her a hand. All of those things are helping men to connect and move closer in a community where men can be real, okay, and share something of their life together. You've just been doing that a bit this morning, just now, sharing how you came to faith, okay? So that's vitally important. A strong and robust community of men is absolutely vital. This bloke who's written Why Men Hate Going to Church says something like, men will come to a church where there's a strong and there's a robust fellowship of blokes. So the community of men will grow and grow stronger. Not only that, but women will be attracted to that, and the whole issue of church community will become much more attractive because they see that men are taking a leadership role. Now, that's not to say that women can't take a leadership role, but the dominant culture of our day is still that men take a lead, and most wives are very happy when their husbands take a strong lead. The other thing that I've found which is really important about ministry amongst men is this. Aussie men have this pretty simple view of life. Peter McPherson and Wei Han and the clergy, they're paid to do this. This is their job. We all play roles from time to time, whether we're dads or granddads or whether we're in charge of a business unit at work or whether we're an engineer or whatever it is we're doing. Most blokes are happy, and they know there's a role to do. The clergy's role is to speak the gospel. The powerful thing in Australian culture is that when men who are not clergy stand up and share their faith and talk about that, my experience is that Aussie men do that or respond to that and say, wow, maybe I should be doing this. Maybe I should be thinking this way. Now, for the last 30 years, I want to tell you that that's been one of the theses on which I've been attempting to encourage men in the church, that as we come for a breakfast like this, men would come who are laymen, not clergy, that they come and just share what it is that what it means to be a Christian in their world. And so we've consistently tried to do that on most breakfast days. Here's some really useful stuff. Now, I'm going to give you a copy of this, but it really is significant. If you're a dad or a granddad or a prospective dad, then you need to just understand this. This is from a survey in Switzerland. These surveys don't happen all that often. It was done in 1994, and the results were made available in the year 2000. The study was of a population of people who were around the church. It's a study that reveals religious practice of fathers and their families, and above all determines the future attendance or the absence of men from the church. So the first thing they found is if both dad and mum attend regularly, then down the track 33%, one-third of their kids will become regular church attenders, and a further 41% will end up attending irregularly. So that's nearly 75%, okay, will be either irregular or regular attenders, but 33% will be regular attenders. If dad is irregular, he doesn't go very often, but mum is regular, then 3% of the children will become regular themselves, while a further 59% will become irregular. So, mum and dad come, 33% of kids will become regular attenders. If it's only mum who comes, 3%. 38% will be lost. If the father is non-practicing and the mother is regular, in other words, dad never darkens the door of the church, only 2% of children will become regular worshippers. You often hear, you know, men in particular, and I've heard it often, and perhaps you have too, where we say things like, when they grow up, they can make the choice for themselves. Only 2% will, general 2 or 3% will be regular worshippers after that. Over 60% in that last scenario, over 60% of children will be lost completely to the church. What happens if the father is regular but the mother is irregular or non-practicing? Amazingly, the percentage of children becoming regular goes up from 33% to 38% and up to 44%, up to 38%. This suggests that the loyalty to the father's commitment grows in response to the mother's laxity or indifference to religion. In short, if a father does not go to church, no matter how faithful his wife's devotions are, only one child in 50 will become a regular worshipper. If a father goes regularly, regardless of the practice of the mother, between two-thirds and three-quarters of their children will become churchgoers, either irregularly or regularly. Now, I think you can see from that sort of statistic that dads and men in the community have a really significant role to play. This is not a survey that's done all that frequently, and I don't have any other data except that. As I try and read widely about stuff that's in the community about men and the societal roles and how it all is working out. I'm quite sure that there's a whole range of things not yet surveyed where the influence of men is absolutely paramount, but nobody has really done the work on that. So I just want to underscore, men are important, and you can take that away and share it with those at home. Just want you to think about families for a moment. Take a moment to talk to the folk again near to you. I'd like you to consider this question here. Who's the most important person in the family? Is it mum? Is it dad? Or is it the kids? Have a chat about that for 2 minutes. Okay. Now I hope you've plumbed the depths of that in 2 minutes. Just want to take a straw poll here. Just indicate if you think it's mum is the most important member of the family. Okay. Two, the option is dads. Where are dads in all of this? Yeah, somewhat less. What about the kids? Okay. We've got a few undecideds here this morning. Well, it is a bit of a tricky issue, isn't it? Well, the reality is that the family needs, you know, to everybody in the family, of course, is important. But from time to time, each of them will play, you know, different and significant roles in circumstances and so on. So that was not an easy question to perhaps come to terms with, and it just depends on the circumstances. Yeah, yes, Bill?
Just amongst the three of us, when we were talking, we sort of recognise the kids think the mum, because she's at home, And the one thing, the dad never seems to get recognised for providing the income that enables things to function in the household. And we all felt the same thing, actually.
Who identifies with that? Yeah, it's a bit of an issue, isn't it? Still in our culture, there's been many societal changes, men are still often thought to be the protector and provider, the two P's, the protector and the provider. Now, sometimes that in today's culture, that often might the provider might be the mum, and dad might be at home. But I want to tell you, 50 years ago, that notion was quite foreign. And as men, we need to be thinking pretty significantly about, what our role is and how we try and make that work. It's not an easy issue. Sorry, Bruce, you wanted to...
I was just going to say that that's true. I think mum's become the nurturer, though.
Yeah. Probably in most families, the mum is sort of seen to be the nurturer, and dad as the sort of protector provider, or more provider rather than the protector. The protector was probably in days of swords and chivalry and that sort of stuff. Okay. Well, if you think about it, in some places in the world, not far from in the world today, that's a pretty reliable thing. If you think about some lands like Sudan and Somalia and some of these places, this is in Iran, this is not much fun, and life and roles are quite different. Let me just say that one of the best gifts a dad can give to their child is to love their mum. Okay? That's one of the best gifts you're able to give, and to provide that role model. I can't remember the number of times that when I've struck a problem as a father, and I would often think back to the way in which my dad might have handled that situation. Now, my dad's been gone for 30 years. But I often might still think about that. He was fortunate in that I came along. I said also at my brother's funeral, I said, when there's only two in the family and there's 13 years between you, then the best spin you can put on being number two is that you were an afterthought. So my dad had a fair bit of practice before I came on the scene, for which I'm pretty grateful. He was 45 when I was born. Pretty shortly, I'm going to ask you a question just about how much change has taken place in your lifetime for blokes. But in the meantime, I just want you to think about this. Think about families and your family and what you observe in the community. How does the family rate in importance in your view of the world? How important does it rate? If it's very, very important, it's a number 10. If it's, inconsequential, then it's number 0 or 1. Have that conversation with the folks next to you. Where is the family right, the family being in general, that unit of life. In the Australian culture, what you experience, what you observe, okay? How significant is the family? 2 minutes for that. Okay, if we can just gather around and collect our thoughts here. Can I just ask you to indicate, if you thought the family was up around the number 10, number 10, number 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Okay. Well, we're all above 5. Can I say that I was listening to the radio the other day, and Lindsay Fox was being interviewed, And Lindsay, as I think most of you will know, was a sort of a trucking magnate who's grown his business from one truck to, thousands of trucks, I suspect, and is highly regarded in the business community, not only for his role in that, but because he has also paved the way for lots of employment opportunities, both in his organisation and elsewhere. And Lindsay had just the previous night been recognised by the business community of Melbourne, very influential group of people in business, and they had recognised him for his unique role in business in Melbourne, not only because of his business but because of his influence. And Lindsay is not one who's short of a word, and he responded and he said, "It all starts with the family. If you want to succeed in life, you need to think carefully about how that family unit works. This is where people gather values and are cared for and nurtured and guided and educated in all of life." And so it was interesting. I don't know where Lindsay stands with the Lord. Frankly, he used to play eons ago. He used to play for the St Kilda Football Club, and he's been closely associated with them ever since. But that's what Lindsay had to say. And that's my conviction as well. When I had opportunity to succeed and go to places far away like London, and work there and further a career, I made a judgment about our family. At the time it was ageing parents, but also young kids, and say, can they cope with this? Apart from the fact, can I cope with it? But can my wife and family cope with this? We didn't do that, and so we pretty much stayed here, partly because this community provided much of the emotional and spiritual support, which was vital. We spend lots of time in this church to build marriages, to strengthen marriages. We do things like have the marriage course, the marriage preparation course. Amongst men's ministry from time to time, we've run a series on winning at work and home, which is about a 16-series DVD on partly about relationships with spouses, but also helping kids and how we might be a Christian in the workplace. And things like What Your Dad Didn't Tell You About Women that Daniel Fengler has done. So all of that is important in building up the family. Just want you to spend a couple of minutes now just identifying one important thing that you have observed about the changing role of, say, men in society over the last 50 years. If you can think back that far, or what you've heard your dad talking about, or what you've observed, okay? Just have that conversation. What are the changing roles and changes that have come upon the whole issue for men in the community? Okay. Now, lots of things have probably gone on in conversations here, and we won't have a time to plumb all of that. But let me tell you just one thing that's changed. I haven't yet been married for 50 years, but it's getting within a couple of years close. When we married in 1964, both the organisation for which I was working, the Commonwealth Bank, and my wife's organisation, the AMP Society, both, significant names in financial circles still in Australia, neither organisation would employ married women. So there's a
single to start with and got married. I think they had to leave.
So yeah, that's right. Had to leave, Peter. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Now there were a few exceptions crept in, but broadly speaking, the policy was. I think that was a bit of a hangover from World War II. Men came back from the war. Women had been holding the fort in lots of jobs, and returned servicemen needed employment to sustain the family.
Now, if you sort of hold that up as a sort of model of economic, employment opportunities now, you'd just about be mown over in the avalanche, wouldn't you? Okay. So what I'm about to tell you is a little bit about my personal story here in this community, because I hope it might give you a bit of a wider vision of what it is that men can do and how they can influence one another. One of the great legacies that I inherited when I came to this church in 1964 was that there was a strong contingent of lay men in the community who were followers of Jesus and had set up this church in this timber hall, as it was then, a very multi-purpose hall, as early as 1962. Most of you will be aware that this year we're celebrating our 50th anniversary of St Alfred's through Connect 50. Clergy leadership was spread pretty thinly, and hence if anything was going to happen in the church, it was largely up to lay people to pick up the ball and run with it. There was a man in this church, there were quite a number of men in the church, but there's one who sticks in my mind and who I'm telling you about this morning. His wife is still in this church. The man's name was Max Ward. Max was a state bank manager, and perhaps because he was a man in banking and I was a young bloke trying to find out what the world was about and families and what it was to be a Christian, I listened to Max. Max was one of the most godly lay blokes I've ever come upon. His wife is still in this church, and she comes to the 10 o'clock service. Her name's Mary, and they had four boys. The eldest was Gavin. There was a Glyn, there was Roger, and there was a Kerry. Four of them. Max had come to faith, strong faith in Christ, through the Billy Graham Crusade in 1959. There's a lot of men around in Melbourne, in church communities, who have been influenced by that Billy Graham and subsequent crusades. On account of his influence, this man and his family had a significant influence in my life and our family's life, and it's my prayer that you might find men of that sort in this community here as well. Now, I've got the approval of his eldest son, Gavin, to tell this story, and so I don't want you to think that there's anything sort of inappropriate that I'm disclosing here, and Mary knows about what I'm about to say this morning. I watched this man closely. He was authentic, and he had a really godly disposition and put the scriptures on a very, very high place. When I first came here in about, as I said, 1964, and by 1965, without being a Christian, I'd been ushered into being a Sunday school teacher. Got to ask some serious questions about that. But I had 50 kids, 50 boys on my roll. There were 400 kids in this Sunday school on the roll. Every Sunday, on average, I would have 35 boys, grade two. Gavin Ward, the eldest son of Max and Mary, was in my class. Over the years, as Elizabeth and I had frequently looked to Max and Mary to model and aspire to, and for them to inspire us about what it was to be a Christian and have some sort of a Christian family. Gavin had been a leader of the youth group. It was the days when youth in this community, we grew our own youth leaders. My eldest son, Stephen, was a younger member, probably 6 or 7 years or 8 years behind Gavin, but he found his way into the youth group. And he looked to Gavin as a mentor and as a friend and, dare I say it, fellow supporters of the Essendon Football Club. Hooray! Now, after Gavin had finished his schooling, he applied for a job and he came to me for a reference. I seemed to do a few of those around about that time, which I was delighted to give. And I said something like this in his reference. I just mention again, Gavin knows I'm passing this on. This young man comes from a marvellous family where the highest standards of behaviour are both practised and encouraged. He'll be a great employee. And then I went on to pen something which I now believe God gave me to say, which has stuck with me over 40 years. But I don't know where it's coming from. I said something like, I'm the father of two boys, and I'll be very gratified parent indeed if my sons develop to the same extent and direction as this young man. Now, Gavin joined what was then the Melbourne Metropolitan Board of Works, later to be Yarra Valley Water. He studied his degree part-time and his career advanced rapidly. My son, Stephen, completed his VCE, dabbled in some tertiary study and eventually joined the Commonwealth Bank, my organisation, in about 1980-something. Stephen made good progress, married, had a child and bought a home with the help of his employer's finance. Then quite unexpectedly, my son came to me in about 1997 and said he'd felt that the Lord was calling him to study. And I said, oh, gee, that's pretty good. Yeah, he says, full-time study. I said, you've got a home, a debt, a mortgage, a family. How are you going to make this work? So he'd done a lot of work. He talked to some people who had taken a similar path. And he finished up resigning from the Commonwealth Bank. And he said he felt that the Lord was calling him to what was then Bible College Victoria, which campus was then out at Lilydale. So in 1997, he starts at Bible College Victoria. And who joins him on the campus that same day is Gavin. The Lord had been directing him into ministry. And he started his studies there on that same day, unbeknownst to one another. Both eventually completed their respective studies and are both now full-time in ordained ministry within the Anglican Church. Gavin is a senior minister at Sunbury Parish out in the far western suburbs or fringe of Melbourne, and son Stephen is an associate minister at Glen Waverley Parish, known to many as GWAC, the second largest parish in the Melbourne Diocese. We pray regularly for their ministries and their family. Now, I look back with much gratitude over those years, and there's nearly five decades there, when men have committed their lives to the Lord and to the community in which they're serving and worshipping, and that has been a very powerful thing. And I know in the case of Max and Mary Ward, they've inspired and supported generations of men around their family. I worship with Max Ward here, as I said, for years, and I fellowship with him for several years in a men's growth group, meeting marvellously in the hospitality of the late Max Lucardi and his wife Thelma. She still worships here, and son David. You might know David. David here this morning? Not here. He's often here. Thelma, in discussion one evening, I was prompted to thank Max for the marvellous mentor he had been to Mary and me and to Elizabeth. He was grateful that I'd said that. We all enjoy some encouragement. very shortly after about 1991. Max went to bed one night, rolled over in his sleep, and he was taken by the Lord. Very suddenly. No real hint of serious health. He was about 62 years of age. I was so grateful then that I'd taken the opportunity to speak to Max and thank him for the encouraging ministry that he'd had. So I'm praying, as I just conclude here, I just want to say, I'm praying that each and every one of you might find men in this community who can be that person to you to encourage and build and demonstrate faith, not only in families, but in your friendship group, and be that person of influence and be a mentor. Men in the Australian culture find mentoring a bit of a, you know, a bit of a strange sort of thing. And my experience is that men are mentored often from afar. They look at somebody and they say, yeah, I think I'd like to have some of the attributes of that man. But if there's men in your life that you have been thinking about like that, can I encourage you to speak to them? Let them know that they've been important in your life. I think I might leave it there. There might be some questions or queries for a few minutes, and then we need to wind up. Yes, Bill?
Can I ask a question? Yes. Wasn't all that long ago you said to me one day, because I've just recently become a grandfather, and you said to me, Bill, are you teaching your children how to be grandparents? Because you have taught them how to be parents. I want to elaborate on that a little bit, because at the time you said that, it really hit me in the side of the head. I realised that my children as adults, I taught them how to be parents by my own role model. I suddenly thought, gee, I hope I've done it all right.
I'm just enormously grateful that I've got sons with a couple of families who we're able to participate, you know, closely in from time to time. And I've got a grandson doing VCE this year. So that's a, you know, salutary reminder that life rolls on, and you know, the end of the road might be a lot closer than I think. I tell my family, I said, I don't take tomorrow for granted at this stage of life. I don't take tomorrow for granted. So I've tried to participate in ways with my grandkids which continue to build them up and encourage them and let them know that their parents are the best in the world. And hopefully... I think they probably doubt that themselves, actually. Like most parents, we find the going pretty hard, don't we? Those of us who are parents and going through that, I think we're never too sure on the right way. One of the most liberating things for me as a parent was when I made that decision to follow Christ. I came home from a meeting one night. I don't think I mentioned this before. I came home from a meeting one night, and I considered myself to be a bit of a fraud. I was sort of, you know, playing a bit of a role in the church community here. But and whilst I had this sort of mental assent to the person and the significance of Christ, I hadn't invited him to be in my life in a, you know, personal sort of a way. One Christian man once said to me, Doug, have you made the wonderful discovery of knowing Jesus Christ personally? Now, I'd shirked that. But when I did, I rolled over in bed one night and I said, Lord, I just want to invite you into my life. And immediately I was, just instantaneously, I was flooded with a sense of warmth and love and peace and joy, which was all-consuming. I turned over and went to sleep, and the next day I started this, you know, long journey, which I'm still on, to, you know, be a follower of Christ. So it's... that sort of journey.
Doug, thank you very much for that talk. I think it's good for all of us to be reminded of what our roles are. I think many of us sometimes question that, especially with, as somebody said to me the other day, no man is perfect, and especially married men. Married men hear about it first. You know? But look, Doug, thanks for that. Let me just pray for a short prayer for a moment and say, Lord, we thank you for what Doug has just said to us. And we pray that as men, we can go forward listening to what Doug has said and being better men, fathers, grandfathers in our families and all of the people we're connected with. Lord, and we just commit these men here from that are listening today to you and in their roles going forward in the future.